From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. When hashtag MeToo went viral last October, no one could have predicted how many men and women would add their voices to what has become the name of a movement. After very public allegations of sexual assault against Harvey Weinstein and other powerful, highly visible men, actress Alyssa Milano tweeted, "If all the women who've been sexually harassed or assaulted wrote Me Too, we might give people a sense of the magnitude of the problem." But since that movement has exploded, so too has resistance among men and women. Some say they don't understand what happened to due process, or they don't know what true north is when determining the difference between flirtation and harassment. Some say they're terrified of which powerful male will be the next to take a public fall. In a National Intimate Partner in Sexual Violence survey from the Centers for Disease Control, 1 in 2 women and 1 in 5 men report having experienced sexual violence. The Pew Research Center finds a majority of Americans agree with the idea that men are getting away with sexual harassment and women are not being believed. But a majority of Americans also say the movement has made navigating work male-female relationships more difficult. Our goal today is to explore what some call a spectrum of Me Too moments and why others oppose the notion of arranging traumatic personal events according to degrees. We'll also explore the evolving conversation surrounding harassment, sexual violence, and the cultural conditioning that some experts say contributes to the objectification of women, which leads to harassment and violence. Amy Feith has worked as Crisis Intervention Services Director for the Rape Crisis Center, serving both Brunswick and New Hanover counties, and she's served as Member Services Director and Campus Rape Prevention Coordinator at the North Carolina Coalition Against Sexual Assault. She is currently Executive Director of the Carousel Center, a local nonprofit with national accreditation dedicated to child advocacy and welfare. Amy Feith, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
Chadwick Roberts is an assistant professor in the Department of Communication Studies at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. He specializes in cultural and gender studies and feminist theory. Chadwick Roberts, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us.
And we are, of course, inviting you to join the conversation. What types of discussions are you having with family, friends, partners about the Me Too movement? What's changed? What hasn't changed? Has Me Too caused you to rethink any former romantic relationships? You can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. I don't think there's any debate over the gravity of a crime like rape. Most mentally healthy people take that seriously. But there are some, Amy Feith, who say the Me Too movement, they see it as women whining or being oversensitive or intolerant of maleness itself. Help us understand why so many well-respected, successful men are taking a fall now for sexual harassment. Is the American culture turning against men?
I have been doing work with sexual violence survivors for 30 years, and I would say that I've always thought, and we've always thought, anybody that's been working with me, standing alongside of me as an ally, that it is not about, but we've been branded as male bashers, but the issue is not, I always thought intrinsically we need the men as part of our conversation, because it's not a woman's issue. It's a humanity issue. It's about us coexisting in a world where we do both exist. And so I really get very upset, because I think it gives us an excuse not to include half of the population in the problem solving, because it's two people making a relationship, two people, and when I say relationship, I'm not talking about our organic relationships. It can be that, but I'm just saying meeting somebody on the street that happens to not be your same sex. I think it's very important for us to stop trying to excuse the conversation and use this as an opportunity to reopen a dialogue. I think that's the important piece, is can we just put our swords down and not talk about woman bashing, male bashing, but how are we going to rectify this? Because 30 years in, we are still talking about the exact same issues. And I that disheartens me on one level, but on the other level, I am thrilled about Me Too, because it is bringing to a national forefront a conversation about this very issue that I've dedicated a career to.
What do you mean 30 years in? Are you talking about your
own career? Yeah.
Your experience
30 years
with it?
I've been doing it. And in 2018, I'm having the same conversations that I had back in 1989 when I started as a volunteer doing work with people who are like, well, don't you think that women just, you know, had sex and they just, you know, feel bad about it the next day and so they lie about being raped. 2018, I still have people asking me that exact same question. Only now in a child advocacy center, I'm hearing the same thing about, you know, 11 and 12-year-old girls. And don't you think, well, maybe, you know, maybe they were dressed a certain way or maybe they acted a certain way that encouraged that person that they know and love that's part of their family to interact with them in a sexual way.
Victim blaming of a child?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Well, that seems like a whole other ball of wax
that we need
to unpack. But first, sure. Chadwick Roberts, you teach a gender studies class at UNCW, mm-hmm. and there is a documentary called Misrepresentation that you show your students that sort of explains how our media culture has shaped perceptions of women and the value of women, which, according to this documentary, primarily lies in their sex appeal. That's the seat of power for women. Talk to us about the dialogue that you have in class. And this is a co-ed class, males and females.
This is a co-ed class. And I use this documentary in a media literacy course, which is a large lecture. And then I use it in a smaller course of 24 that is sexuality and gender. So very different audiences. And the while most of our classes are female dominated, you could imagine that the sexuality and gender and the women's studies courses are a little more female dominated. But I wish those conversations were a little more vibrant. It has a way of shutting down conversations. And when I bring up the lights after that film, there's a lot of silence. And you're reading the faces in the room, and the women are sort of reticent to speak out. And it's often males that speak out and want to dismiss the message of the documentary, saying that this objectification of women isn't quite as big of an issue as the documentary makes it out to be. They're overstating their case, and they run it through the ringer before the women in the room that I can see have connected with that documentary have a chance to chime in.
Now, this might sound really simplistic. We hear this term objectification of women all the time. But what does that really mean? Is there anything wrong with looking at a woman as an object of sexual desire?
Well, I think like a lot of things, it's a matter of degree. I mean, we can think about objectification like the documentary does, which is looking at magazine advertising and film and television and music videos and see very vivid examples of objectification. But I think a lot of it happens on an interpersonal level when we start to see people and treat people as something other than a full human being. And I brought a quote from Laurie Penny. She has a book called Unspeakable Things, and she wrote a little bit about sexual objectification. Sexual objectification doesn't get oppressive until it's done consistently and to a specific group of people and done with no regard whatsoever for their humanity. So I think sometimes we have a too limited conversation about objectification, and we point to magazine fragmenting women's bodies and showing them as objects, but you can treat someone as an object or begin to do that on an interpersonal level.
How does that happen? Can you give us a kind of hypothetical example, either of you, Amy Feith or Chadwick Roberts, of an interpersonal situation, something that somebody here in the Cape Fear region might run into on a regular basis?
I can give an example from a male student. So I often have male students, this was a straight male student, approach me and say, how can I speak to women in a way that doesn't objectify them? And I said, well, you may want to start off with a comment that's not about their appearance. And so and that really took him for a turn, that he should talk to them about the book they're reading or a film that he watched or something he's interested in, and go beyond talking about their body or their hair or some other part of them. Just start the conversation in a different way. And that blew his mind. And these are college students. It blew his mind that
to talk to a female about something other than how she looks.
Yes.
And we're talking maybe 2018.
Yes.
An 18-year-old mm-hmm. today.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And I think, like Laurie Penny's writing, there's nothing innately wrong with a little objectification. We all objectify the opposite sex. That's why we're oriented towards them. But you run into problems when it ceases to be about desire and it's instead about control, or it's limiting how you interact with that other human being. You're unable to see the other parts of what they're bringing to the table because of the objectification. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's probably true of journalists, that they're unable to see your talent, your skill, because they get caught up in the difference. And it's something that all men do, gay men do, straight men do. They fail to see the accomplishments, the humanity there. Mm-hmm. And it takes work. And that's sad to admit, but it takes work to do that, to understand this is probably programmed into mm-hmm. male identity, and it's going to take difficult work to reprogram. And that's where you see the resistance from men, is because this actually is difficult work to do, and it's hurtful to think about perhaps you have objectified women in the past. And that's something I admit to my students, that 19-year-old and 20-year-old Chadwick, you know, would go to the gay bars with his female friends and, you know, touch them in ways that may have made them uncomfortable. That's really tough to admit, and it's hard to process something mm-hmm. that happened 20 years ago, and you're saying, I put my friends in a position where they had to tell me to stop, or they should have told me to stop, right?
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. We're taking another look at the Me Too movement about 9 months after a tweet from actress Alyssa Milano. We want to know, what questions have arisen for you since last October, and how these questions are impacting your life? When we come back from this break, we'll hear from some listeners. You can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today we're exploring the Me Too movement and how it's affecting the workplace, personal relationships, and how the conversation between men and women is changing. With us today, Professor Chadwick Roberts of UNCW's Communication Studies and Women and Gender Studies program. We also have Amy Feith, Executive Director of the Carousel Center, a nonprofit serving children who have been victims of abuse. And we want to hear from you on this Thursday. Has Me Too expanded your ability to talk with people of a different gender? Are you confused about what's appropriate and what would be considered over the line? You can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. And if you would like to be anonymous, put that at the top of your email. There are shades in this Me Too movement, and we've talked about a number of them already. A number of famous men have faced public scrutiny and shaming over what they might consider, given their age, but actually given Chadwick Roberts' discussion about 18-year-olds today, maybe not. But case in point, Morgan Freeman, he's 81 years old, a well-known film actor, mm-hmm. beloved for his roles, among other things, in Shawshank Redemption, Driving Miss Daisy. He's faced allegations of not just inappropriate comments, but unwanted touching of females who've worked on his films and for his production company. He's been accused of touching women on the lower back when he's talking to them, trying to lift up their skirts, asking them if they're wearing underwear. Some men would, if they were among men, laugh at this and say, he's just playing with them, he's flirting with them, he's engaging with them, letting them know that they're attractive to him, and that's a compliment, isn't it, Amy Feith? I mean, he's not throwing them down and, you know, violently assaulting them.
And I think it always goes back to just basic tenets of communication. And those basic tenets are what your intention as the message giver may not be what the message receiver's perception is. And I think that I would have to know more about those contexts before I could make a comment about that. But I do think when you are more familiar with a person, there is some jocularity and a little more grace and a little bit more latitude when somebody is doing the behaviors you're describing. But if you're in a setting such as a movie set and it's a big star and you happen to not have the exact same level of power and influence, or let's say you're trying to make it in that industry, or you're trying to, are you going to be more or less inclined to tell somebody that that's really not helpful, or it makes me uncomfortable when you do that? If you don't have an equal power position, or you see that there is a way that if I offend this person, I could get fired from the set, I could get my blacklisted in the industry. And then the other thing I always like to just share with folks when I talk about this issue is you can be a brilliant, brilliant actor and also a person who is an offender. You can be both of those things. We can be both. Great teachers and amazingly able to connect with students, but also be abusing them. You can be an amazing defensive line coach for a football team at a prominent Big Ten college and also be a child molester. There can be both that can exist in one person.
Yeah. Nice guys can have Me Too moments, mm-hmm. too. But I think, mm-hmm. to me, it's coercive when you're unable to say no. Mm-hmm. So if you feel like you're unable to say no with the Morgan Freeman example, then it's coercive. And again, that's a matter of degree, too. How much are you absolutely unable to say no? Able to say no, but then you have to leave and you lose your job, or exactly. unable to say no and it's awkward, or you get called a B word, or you know, exactly. something along those lines. That we've created structures where it's difficult for women to push back. And then, you know, going back to my own life example, if I've put my female friends in a position where they feel like they have to go above and beyond and create boundaries because I'm not respecting their own boundaries, that's on me.
So how does someone in a position, and let's stick with the Morgan Freeman example because mm-hmm. that's been so public, but if no one ever says to him, look, buddy, you can't do that, and I don't know whether people did or not, but let's just use mm-hmm. it as an example. How is someone like that ever supposed to learn? He, you know, naturally reacted to these public allegations in shock and said something like, you know, he never intended to make anyone feel objectified or small. He thought he was giving women compliments. How do we start to change that dynamic, Chadwick Roberts, or either?
I mean, for me, I'm just sitting here because we're going to use him as our example. But I think that a little bit that teases out for me is that we can't entirely separate the intersectionality of a racial component for Morgan Freeman as an example, as opposed to, say, Harvey Weinstein, because I do think there's a rich history that follows somebody who is a person of color that is accused of a Me Too moment that has some undertones that intertwine with the racist piece that we're not talking about today. But if I were going to talk about what do you do if you're surprised by that, I would have to say that I get that you might push back and be surprised and maybe a little bit defensive. But I do think that if we're going to have the conversation going forward and we want to have people honoring the equality and the richness that all humanity can offer, then you have to get past that, be willing to push past that, and be willing to be open to hear that maybe you did hurt somebody's feelings, or maybe you did take it a step too far. And I think that goes for women as well. In the Me Too movement, the other side of the coin is, if we are asking to be heard and we want people to understand the Me Too experience, I find myself even more so making sure that with my interactions with men, am I also, because it was built in, just like for this 18-year-old that he was talking about that's a student, that's how you're indoctrinated, that's how their friends teach them to talk to women that they're trying to talk to and maybe get a date with. That's what their dads, their uncles, their brothers, everybody, like, that's a rich history of ingrained gender communication that says this is how you approach a woman that you find attractive, that you want to maybe ask out on a date. Conversely, women are also experiencing that other side of that, which is we have a rich history of we'll accept it and be passive maybe and be kind because we don't want to hurt your feelings up front. But amongst the young women, amongst our women peers, we are being jocular, or maybe we do get feisty and push back in a way that is equal, or we see as equal, where I might say, oh, you know, nice chest, if they say nice chest, and I might do the same to a male. I think it's important for us to take a step back to say, okay, but we have to also recognize, are we putting people in an uncomfortable position as well? It's about humanity. And if we want to see it that way, we have to really be cognizant now. And I find myself saying that in a, I've worked mostly and predominantly all female work environments because of the job that I have chosen. And we have one male counselor and one male volunteer at the Carousel Center. And I find myself frequently amongst the women there saying, hey, you know, we need to be cognizant that we do have men that work with us and that may not feel real comfortable to hear us talking about this stuff.
You mean, what are you talking about when you're objectifying a man?
Or
is that what you mean?
Yes. Or when we're creating a conversation, or when the conversation may be very specific to women stuff, that for instance, if you're sitting there talking about, oh, well, it's my time of the month or whatever it is, to me, it's not exactly equal, but it is a little bit, if I'm wanting to be cognizant, I have to, as the leader, I have to say, hey, listen, this is part of that. We have to create a culture that's not uncomfortable for men to be a part of the conversation. So let's do our part too on that side of it.
But I think when thinking about Morgan Freeman, there are sort of two ways that feminists have been dealing with this and women have been dealing with this since the 1970s, and that's legal litigation, and that's not really part of the conversation with Morgan Freeman. And then there's collective action, that this is the fact that this was more than one woman coming forward forced a response from him that probably would not have happened any other way. There probably wasn't enough to have a legal case, and it probably wouldn't have happened if one woman said it, she would have been dismissed. But the collective action of all of these women saying the same thing and confronting him together within that industry got a certain response.
Life coach Tony Robbins recently stepped into hot water when he was at one of his big events in California talking about the Me Too movement.
Yep.
And he said, and you're nodding, Amy mm-hmm. Feith, he said that so many women are using this as a way of claiming victimhood instead of empowering themselves. And he's since apologized about this in a tweet saying that he clearly has a lot left to learn about it. But he raised a bunch of points that I think are still part of this conversation that some people just don't want to bring up. There are so many elements of this that are uncomfortable for people mm-hmm. to admit. You know, they'll say, sure, I support not objectifying women and seeing women as whole human beings. And then they silently think to themselves, but women spend so much time, money, and energy trying to look sexually appealing to men. Isn't that part of it? Aren't women doing this? Don't they want to be called hot? Don't they want to be seen as objects of sexual desire? Isn't that what the whole beauty industry is about? So what do you say to that? Because there is that other thread to this conversation.
I'd say that makes a lot of assumptions about why women want to wear makeup or purchase clothes or purchase handbags, that they're conforming to gender norms within their own groups. They're bonding within their own groups. Not all women are attracted to men and dressing up for men. So there are a lot of assumptions that are embedded there.
It is, and I think that the beauty of our current cultural climate is that we are having conversations that are broader, that have a broader spectrum and a broader embracing of, you know, when I heard that, if it were 50 years ago, or if I'm talking to my 85-year-old mother, of course, her response would be, yes, women, that's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to look our best at all times, and that's part of it. This is how you do that, to look better, your best. In this day and age, my first response is, well, that would assume that the woman is even inclined sexually to men, in which case then perhaps, yes, they are. And but most often we are trying to be looking the best that we can look for whatever the reason.
And part of it is just about employment, that you have to be attractive and appropriately dressed for work. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that I looked into the history a little bit here and went back to Estelle Friedman's book, Redefining Rape. She's got an entire chapter on mashers. And this is back at the turn of the last century, the progressive era. They were these men who would harass women on public transportation and harass them in hotel lobbies, harass them on the street. And it went from, you know, what we now call street harassment to actually touching and grabbing women. And women fought back with hatpins and umbrellas and took self-defense classes. So your great-grandmother has a Me Too story. Mm-hmm. This is not a new story. And it's about women having access to public space, having access to jobs, and being able to move through space without being harassed and having unwelcome comments and pokes and grabs from people, men on the street.
Mm-hmm. Some men have said the cultural norm has always been the dominant male pursuing the female. And, you know, in the heterosexual dynamic, that's part of the appeal between both, for the man and the woman, part of the flirtation, part of the courtship. Some women say no because they want to see the guy work harder. They want to seem to be more of a prize. And I know both of you are cringing right now, but we have to unpack this because it is part of the narrative around this gender dynamic. Sometimes a woman will say no to a man, and she means try harder. So how are men supposed to understand what's flirtation, what means pursue this a little more, go for the goal, and what is really no? Amy Feith.
So we talk a lot about, and when we're doing education, when you're working with survivors and you're doing intervention with survivors, that's a crisis situation. But the bigger, broader responsibility of a rape crisis center or a child advocacy center is, what is the prevention component? How can we make this not be somebody's experience? And I think when you talk about that, you're talking about consent. And I'm glad to see a lot more conversations about consent. And I think that it always has to be, and I too was guilty of it, even though I'm 30 years into this career, that it's a destination when it really isn't. Consent is a fluid journey, and it is constantly needing to have confirmation. And the only way I can have confirmation, which is difficult for us as human beings because we don't want to be rejected. No one wants to be rejected. But I think that you have to ask. I think you have to be perceptive about the person. Well, you have to care, first of all, if you are a person that doesn't care what's happening coming back from what you say and seeing a response, then I do think that you might have a little harder work there. But I think that it's about just confirming, ooh, did that hurt your feelings? If you see a response from a person you're talking to, did I make you uncomfortable? I'm sorry if that made you uncomfortable. But to acknowledge that you're visually taking that cue in.
And I think men have to be better at reading nonverbal cues. I mean, it makes me think all the way back to the affirmative consent debate, the idea of verbalizing. And I think that is necessary. And people like to poke fun at that moment, that period in the 90s when we had that discussion. But it wouldn't be necessary if men were better at reading women's nonverbal, people's bodies, their eyes, their faces can tell you if they're uncomfortable or not.
How can they get better at that?
You have to want to be better at it. You have to acknowledge that there's a problem first, and it takes effort.
And in the world we live in today, we are not intrinsically practicing dialogue that is like what we're doing right now, where I can see your eyes, I can hear your voice tone, I can see your entire body language, because we are used to communicating through a screen that gives us so little responsibility for what is the impact of my message on the receiver. We get a pass. And the other thing is, we're not practicing tangible communication skills that will allow us to navigate that perception of the impact of my message. If I can see you tear up, then I know that whatever I've said has profoundly impacted you. And am I human enough to acknowledge and validate, clearly I've upset you by what I've said, and I'm sorry. Or I did not mean to make you feel that way. I'm sorry if that hurt your feelings.
So this is not necessarily about trying to get men to walk on eggshells around women. This is about keeping that dialogue and that sensitivity and that receptivity to reactions open.
Yeah, and I think so. Culture has taught men to really bifurcate their head from their heart. And every human being, whether they're male or female, has the ability to use empathy. Mm-hmm. That is what separates us from other animals. And that is not a muscle that men are encouraged to use regularly. But like any muscle, it can be developed. It should be developed if we want to have the kind of world that we want to live in. And I think that you have to first, at a base level, care about the response. You know, be able to see it and then care that you're making someone uncomfortable. And there are sadly some men in the world that do not care.
Is that part of our cultural conditioning? Do we train young boys to just plow ahead and not care and not pay attention?
Well, objectification of women has become part of male bonding. And I think that's the role of men in the Me Too moment, is that you have to work within your own spaces as men. There are no women in the men's locker room to intervene. There are no feminists there. Men will have to police other men's locker room talk or locker room behavior. Mm-hmm. And if there are sexist comments, men have to be the one to intervene in their own groups.
Professor Chadwick Roberts, I want you to really unpack that idea of locker room talk. If there are no women in the room, what's the problem?
Well, our thoughts become our actions, and we're creating frames and contexts for interpersonal interactions that set the wrong precedent for how to engage with other humans. So it's degrading to women, and that degradation doesn't stay in the locker room. It follows men around into their interpersonal relationships. That's where the problem lies, is that sexist comments become sexist attitudes, and it just becomes harder and more difficult to address.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. It's a look at the Me Too movement and how individual conversations are changing. Have you had any personal revelations about your own attitudes or behavior since this began last October? Do you think this is largely a male-bashing witch hunt? Are there aspects of it you don't understand, you're too embarrassed to ask about? Call or email us on this Thursday if you'd like to be anonymous. You can put that in a note at the top of your email. The address is coastline@whqr.org. The phone number is 910-343-1138. When we come back from this break, we'll hear from Eric from Wilmington. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today we have Amy Feith, Executive Director of the Carousel Center, a nationally accredited local nonprofit that serves children who have been victims of abuse, Professor Chadwick Roberts of UNCW's Communication Studies Department and Women and Gender Studies Program is also with us, and they're answering your questions today about the Me Too movement, how that's affecting individual conversations among folks in the Cape Fear region. You can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. This is the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question or comment in. And if you want to be anonymous, put that at the top of your email, please. Eric from Wilmington called in and said, Me Too is empowering women, but there is a new subset of men called incels, a movement that thinks women are out to get them or are for them. How are we going to reach these people or tackle these beliefs? Chadwick Roberts. And explain to us incels briefly.
Incels, or the incel movement, is involuntary celibacy. And there are some men that feel that they are entitled to women's attention and affections. And they're blaming women when they are unsuccessful in love and sex. Maybe that's the simplest way to put it. I think the biggest roadblock here is, again, not seeing is the objectification of women, to fall back on that term. If you're not seeing a woman as a full human being, you're not acknowledging their agency and humanity, their ability to make choices, it leads you to these spaces on Reddit and other places online where incels hang out. And we were just discussing locker room behavior. That has moved online into these spaces where it's nonstop, all male. Right. As women have taken up more space in the real world and in professions and schools, men have retreated into these dark recesses of the Internet. And that's where the incel movement comes from and where it thrives. And that's why the words are important. The discussions that men are having are important to talk about because they reinforce this kind of behavior until it becomes violent.
When you talk about a human being as less than a human being, as certain body parts, then it becomes much easier to not see that person as a human being and then act
violently.
It's
the objectification mixed with the misogyny. Right, and it's the unevenness of the objectification because, of course, you could have a whataboutism with, well, men are objectified by women or objectification is part of all mating rituals, but it's a matter of degree. It's about power. It's about misogyny.
We have an anonymous email. Hearing about Morgan Freeman, I was jolted into remembering an upsetting experience on a film set locally. We had a lot of rain that delayed filming, so I spent time hanging out with fellow actors. When the skies cleared and my scene came up, I went to my first mark and prepared to go. When the director called action, a man I had been chatting with came up behind me and pressed himself against me with an erection. As a rape survivor, an incest survivor, my first reaction to something like that is to freeze. This anonymous writer says, I didn't say anything, but I missed my cue. The scene had to be restarted, which made me look bad. All I could do in the moment was ignore the man, take a deep breath, and do my work. Amy Fee.
Yeah, it was just absorbing that and thinking to myself, man, I probably would have turned around and punched him. But that's exactly the point when you finished it with what that person's experience was, because it is very intrinsic, because we are animals, human animals. Our natural response to a traumatic situation is to fight, flight, or freeze. And it is so important that we understand everybody is different. Everyone is different, and every situation is different. So given six other circumstances, one person is going to react differently to every six of those if they occur. In that situation, first of all, thank you, Anonymous, for sharing that very painful experience, which I can only imagine has so much that impacts your ability to have livelihood and to decide whether you want to be a part of that industry. And maybe not the first time either, but I
also just want to point out, if this was on a local film set and it was a big budget film that was here, this person had very little power. This person was probably feeling very lucky to have that part. And when you mess up a shot, that's money. That's time. That's the whole crew and the rest of the cast and everybody involved in that. That's a lot of pressure to have on one person. And so this person was making a decision in that moment.
Yeah. And so Sophia,
accept the blame.
Yes.
Sophia, to accept the blame.
Yes.
Sophia Bush from One Tree Hill has had similar Me Too stories about working in Wilmington and the showrunner for One Tree Hill. Mm-hmm. And so everyone from day workers that are there to play a character for a day to ongoing characters. But she pointed out, you know, we're 20-year-old kids involved in this industry.
We have another email. Anonymous says, hi, as someone who has been sexually assaulted in public 30 years ago and have experienced many instances of verbal assault from superiors and supervisors, I take this issue seriously. Now I think before I touch. Previously, I would put a hand on a man's shoulder or tell a young man he was cute. Now I think about this and don't touch anyone that I don't know well. I don't joke about cute butts or body parts unless it is a close friend and this is part of the way we interact. This is a great thing. Now I can compliment them on something. I have to think first. Changing that conversation. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this is a female writer.
But I think as a culture, we don't talk enough, particularly as American culture, we don't talk enough about sexuality. And in those gray areas of not talking are where misunderstandings happen and predators take advantage of that gray area. Mm-hmm. So the gray area and the ambiguity is rife for exploitation. But it's about our inability to talk openly about, and I think sex gets better when you talk about it. Everything is benefits from having a conversation about what people like and when they would like it to happen. All those things are very healthy. And even to the point of asking if you can kiss someone, that maybe that sounds old-fashioned. I'd always do. It how wonderful to get permission and know that that is wanted. And I don't understand it any other way other than pop culture being grabbed and kissed against your will, particularly for a woman, is something we see a lot in popular culture from Gone with the Wind on. But it's part of our iconography, but it really needs to be challenged.
And really, from fairy tales on.
Yeah.
I mean, Sleeping Beauty is a perfect example of that. She didn't even have the ability to consent, but, you know, so, you know, I'm just saying, like, for me, organically, when you're talking about that situation, that's exactly what I was talking about before, which is that just richness for all of us, too, to just take a pause, to use this as an opportunity to open the conversation. But you're right. When you talk about how Americans talk and interact about sexuality, which is a disservice on many levels, because if I don't understand that I am a human animal that is also a biological machine, certain prescribed buttons are pushed that have certain prescribed responses that follow, like any other machine does. And you have three primary drives: hunger, thirst, and sex. And so if we are not going to talk about what is the healthy piece of that and how does it naturally function, then you're giving people less tools to decide what their autonomy can be, where is my boundary, and how do I feel confident in that boundary so that I can also do a very good job of communicating that clearly or physically communicating that clearly.
Now, is that part of the issue? Because, you know, there are shades here. And Chadwick Roberts, you talk about keeping this conversation open and asking for permission. And Amy Feith, you've also talked about checking in with the person every step of the way because it's consent is a fluid thing. Mm-hmm. But what about the woman or girl who doesn't feel empowered to say no? Chadwick Roberts, your example of asking permission to kiss someone, let's say the person on the other end of that question is too uncomfortable or embarrassed to say, no, that's not okay.
A conversation about coercion, and that becomes this mm-hmm. ethical area to explore about what is coercive. Are you reading the body language? Is someone saying yes, but their eyes are saying no? Are they shaking? Are they trembling? Mm-hmm. Are they unable to speak? All of those things would indicate whatever's happening needs to stop and you need to pull back. And that's something that with the Aziz Ansari story, if you really look at that story, and I think he's one of those, you know, nice guys that got involved in a bad spot here, that he could have read, he should have been concerned and wanted to be concerned about her body language and how she was feeling and what she was thinking. And when you stop doing that, you're slipping into objectification. You're seeing that person as less than a full human being that's worthy of, you know, agency and making their own choices.
Do we need to do a better job of teaching our girls that they have full agency and control over their own bodies and that they should be making a mess and being loud and saying no when they're in uncomfortable situations, Amy Feith? Are we failing there?
And I think that's absolutely something that we need to empower young women to do, to find that assertive voice and to have body autonomy. Children especially, I think boys and girls, I cringe. And every time the holidays are coming up, I have a meme that I put out there that says, please don't force your children to sit on somebody's lap or hug somebody or get a kiss from Auntie Ruth if they don't want to. Because what you're teaching them is what they don't want to happen to their body is not as important as whatever the social construct that says you have to do this etiquette thing that allows you to be kissed by Auntie Ruth that you don't like, right?
And it may not be that Auntie Ruth is a predator.
Correct.
But you're still sending that child the message.
It's that still about body autonomy.
Your body doesn't belong to you.
Exactly. And the other thing I want to be careful about here is this is not about just girls. And it's not about just the person who is the victim or the survivor, because that's where we've gotten it wrong, in my opinion, in doing this work, is that we focus a whole lot in our society on what victims can do to not be victimized instead of focusing on a society that says, stop victimizing people that do it. Whether you're male or female as a perpetrator, stop doing that. It is not okay. We don't want you as part of our society. And I think that one of the things that surprises me is that there are a lot of great men in the world who have no propensity to do harm to another human being that are taking the bad rap for the small percentage that do take advantage of the gray areas and are predators and do like to use that power and control because of whatever insecurities they have as men. And so I think it's really important for us to also educate our young men that it is okay to hear no and not feel unworthy. It is not about being unworthy of whatever your request was. if you ask me, can I kiss you? And I say no, it's not because you're gross or you're awful. It could be, but it doesn't necessarily automatically make you an unworthy person. Yeah. It is the question you asked and the response was and that answer.
I want to get to that idea of victims of sexual assault and harassment. Is there a danger, Amy Feith, in identifying as a survivor of sexual assault? And I'm thinking again of this issue that Tony Robbins raised in terms of the Me Too movement and how you could take on the identity of a victim and then live that way the rest of your life, and you're missing the opportunity to empower yourself. What do you say to that?
I say that that is a very personal and individual experience that every survivor is going to go through. And our experience tells us that if you've been victimized as an adult, likely you were victimized as a child and probably in your adolescence as well. So I appreciate what he's trying to say in his entire worldview, and what he tries to do is that lifting people up to look at the glass as half full, not half empty. And I appreciate those pieces. And I think that that's great. I think we should always try to focus there, but not everybody's there. And it's because not everybody has lived an experience that makes that glass look half full in an organic way on a good day. I just think we have to meet where people are, and I think that we have to trust that people know where they are and how they've perceived and accepted what is happening to them, and we just need to give them that grace.
And briefly, one of the other issues he raised, which I think is an issue that's out there, is he says more than a dozen men in positions of power have told him that they hesitate to hire attractive women even when those women were more qualified than men because it's too big a risk, seeming to imply here that the blame for those situations isn't with the men making the hiring decisions, but with the women for making themselves liabilities. How do we get past that? A couple of eye rolls in the room, which is understandable, but that is what is happening in 2018. I mean, there are men who really don't understand how to have this conversation, and so they're sidestepping it.
And I would argue that is not true. I don't believe that they don't know how to have the conversation. I think they are actively choosing not to, because these are what you're talking about are CEOs of companies that make billions of dollars globally, but they can't understand that the best person for the job is the best person for the job. And if that happens to come in a female form, what are we going to do to make sure that that person who's going to ultimately, the world is driven by the dollar, the almighty dollar, really? We can't figure out the strategy in corporations that are going to make it so that that woman who happens to be the best person for the job is going to be able to exist, and we're not going to be able to, as the men in that corporation, control ourselves enough to not make that environment uncomfortable. I don't agree. I think it lets them off the hook. I think that it makes us give excuses. Boys will be boys. Oh, we just can't change. Oh, we can't control ourselves. I don't agree with that. I think every human being has the ability to think and reason, and I think that we can all take responsibility for our choices and behavior.
And they're selling men short.
Yes.
As a man, I expect better from other men. That men can do better than that. And I think the conversation has been about litigation and mitigating liability. And if you look back through the 1980s, the entire media narrative, if there was one about sexual harassment, was one about lawsuits and one about managing risk. So putting training in so you're managing risk so that you're not losing money. And I think that was not originally the conversation that feminists were trying to have. They had some really incredible, successful litigation in the late 70s and early 80s. After the term was coined in 1975, sexual harassment, but it has been about mitigating risk and avoiding conversations.
Agreed.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Chadwick Roberts, Amy Feith, thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caroline DeVries is our webmaster. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org. Get the podcast, find it on the WHQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 2. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.